We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we work and live, the Awabakal and Worimi people, and pay our respects to elders past and present. We celebrate the stories, culture, and traditions of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders of all communities who also work and live on this land.
You're listening to Boob to Food, the podcast with Luca McCabe and Kate Holm. There is so much noise in the parenting space.
And we don't mean the tantruming toddler. We understand it can feel confusing, conflicting, and overwhelming.
That's why we are bringing our years of experience as a midwife, nutritionist, and naturopath.
And of course, mums.
So that you can confidently navigate the roller coaster of motherhood from boob to food and beyond.
Each week, you'll hear practical wisdom, expert advice, and inspirational stories of other mums in the depths of this parenting journey.
Let's dive in.
Today's episode is brought to you by Farmer Joe. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Boob to Food, the podcast. Happy birthday, Kate.
Oh, thank you.
I won't sing because that is one of my many non-talents is singing, so I won't make everyone hear that, but happy birthday.
Thanks.
Are you going to disclose how old you were or not?
Oh, my gosh. I turned 38, which I don't know. It's really weird. I've never ever felt funny about like age or aging or anything like that. And then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, it's not a myth. It actually happens and you do age. So I don't know.
You look great for 38. So.
Oh, thanks. I don't know what a 38-year-old's supposed to look or feel like, but yeah, it definitely, I think as the numbers get closer to 40, I just feel like growing up, I mean, you always looked at your parents. I don't know about you, but I always thought like my parents and their friends were old. Like they just, but they weren't. They were heaps younger than I am now.
It's funny when you get that realization that your parents were also like learning how to parent when you can remember it.
Mike and I were just saying that, like, you know, we've just come back from camping for a few days and creating that, you know, family holiday and those memories and then realizing like, it wasn't that long ago we were the kids in that situation and looking at our parents thinking like, oh, they know what they're doing and like, but yeah, or they know everything, they've got it sorted and it's like, oh, no, actually everyone's winging it and yeah, they were younger than I am now.
I know. My dad turned 40 when I was 18 and we went to Fiji. Yeah.
Oh, and super young.
Yeah, he's quite young. And so I clearly remember him turning 40 and be like, oh, my gosh, you're so old, because I was 18 and that's how you talk. And now I think, oh, my gosh, my husband's nearly 40.
Yeah. Well, yeah, Jesse and I are the same. Yes. I remember when we talked, he was like, oh, same year model.
Yes, 85 model. Yeah. Anyway, how was camping? Please let
camping
us know.
Was it was amazing.
Yay.
It
was so I was so like, oh, I hope it's not a fail and then you don't want to come with me. So,
no.
Yay.
We had an amazing time. It was really good. And I'd sort of prepped myself for it to be maybe a bit stressful as we were like learning the ropes and, you know, prepping for bad sleep because it was different and all of those things, but it was great. Like the setup was easy. We were less unprepared than we thought. There's definitely some things that we need to like make it a bit more comfortable, like random things like a pair of scissors that we didn't have in the van and like somewhere to put wet towels to come home, like just little things.
Yeah.
But the van was great. Everyone slept really well. We were comfortable. We just loved it. It was great. The kids had an awesome time. No complaints. Honestly, no complaints at all. The only
except for the washing you come home to or
well, we weren't gone for too long. So it's not too bad. Oh no, but actually the complaint, we came home, so we've got a cat and we'd locked him inside while we were gone and our neighbor was feeding him. And we came home and he had pooed everywhere, which is not something that he does. So we don't know if it was like in protest or anxiety or who knows, but like literally I'm talking, like I opened the door, Imogen was screaming. So I got her out of the car and then Mike was sorting out parking the van and Bowie had fallen asleep. So just Imogen and I came into the house and I opened the front door and I was like, what is that smell? And then I walked through to like the laundry where his kitty litter is and was like, oh, yeah, that's it. And then also saw that there was some on the bath mat. I was like, gross. But then I walked back towards the front of the house and was like, no, there's definitely something here. And he pooed all over Bowie's bed. And I'm not saying, like, literally all over. Like, we've had to go and buy new linen and a new mattress protector because it's, I think, unsavable. So that was the only bad thing about camping.
That's why I don't have animals.
To that. I think that might have tipped Mike over the edge. And anyone's looking for a cat? No. I don't know.
Oh, yep. No. Well, I'm glad the rest of your trip was good and that you it got was sleep. Great. I'm sure everyone will be interested to hear how you went with the newborn. And
honestly, fine. And it was funny because when we pulled up, we were right near where they had, like, it was a caravan park at Shoal Bay, and we were right near the cabins. And I saw that there was like a pea plate car, and they had quite a lot of like bottles and rubbish out the front. I was like, oh no, we're going to be kept awake all night. Like, they're going to be partying and like keeping us awake. And then I realized they were probably looking at us thinking, oh no, they've arrived with a baby. We're going to be kept up all night. But actually neither of those things happened. They were great. Like, they didn't make a noise, and Imogen slept really well. I reckon she slept better than some of the nights at home. So, was good. Same with the kids. And Mike, who doesn't have a proper bed in the van.
Yeah, I was going to say, where did he sleep?
Well, he started the night in Jude's bed, and it's like skinnier than a single bed. Mm. But anyway, they are both small people. So he started there. And then when Bowie called out, he swapped over to her bed. But they were all really happy and comfortable. And I don't know how much longevity there is in that arrangement. But anyway, that's a Mike thing to figure out. So
yeah.
I was very comfortable as well. And yeah, Imogen was amazing. So all in all, it was honestly, it was so, so enjoyable. I look forward, like, we're already trying to book our next trip.
Oh, yay. And it's only going to get, I mean, it's been pretty crappy weather too. So it's only going to get better over the summer.
Even like winter, I was thinking, like, winter camping feels appealing as well, being able to have a fire and not getting woken up at 5 o'clock in the morning because the sun's coming up and then the kids wake up.
You'll get woken up at five because it gets so cold in those vintage vans. But yes.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, maybe that's a benefit to Mike sharing a bed with the kids.
Yeah, that's true. Just make them all and go in one.
Yes. Yeah. And you're dialing in from Byron?
I am. I'm in Byron, yes. So I was camping too when you were.
Yeah.
And then we had a great time, pretty chaotic with it. It was like 20 kids. And yeah, but it was really fun. Kids had a ball. And then I came home for 2 days, and now I'm in Byron Bay for a little bit of work. And then tomorrow all my girlfriends arrive for our annual like girls trip that we have here every year. So
very good.
Oh, I'm so excited. It's the longest I've been away from the kids ever. So 5 days I'm away.
Wow.
Yeah. I left this morning at 5 a.m. and drove here. It's like a 7-hour drive. Mm. And anyway, so excited.
Yeah. How good.
Will, after camping, he got another cold sore, and he's always really whingy when he gets cold sores. And anyway, so after 2 days I was like, see ya. My husband was like, please don't leave. And I was like, sorry.
Oh, bye. No.
So funny, because last year I came and I was like still expressing and, you know, I was only here for 3 nights, but like my heart was still really at home. Whereas this time I feel no heart at home, which is not very nice. I'm sure after a few days I will, but I was like, get me out the door.
Yeah.
After being camping with them and then, whinging Will for a few days and then all the sickness we had before that, I was just like, I'm ready to tap out.
Yeah, and everything else that's been going on work-wise.
Yeah, work's been pretty stressful. So
yeah,
behind the scenes, lots going on. So anyway, it's all good. But I'm here finalising our new book, which is coming out in the new year, which is really exciting. So I met the graphic designer today and just finessing everything. It's looking so good. So
I can't wait to see.
Yes, but yeah, I'm in a hotel room by myself at the moment and it is very nice.
So good. Except that you're literally traveling by us. Oh, no, only until tomorrow. I was going to say, you have no one to talk to.
No, I'm going out for dinner tonight with our podcast managers, and I've been with the graphic designer all day. So I've literally been with
you all
day. So I'm okay. My extrovert self's okay. I had about 10 minutes to myself and between our chat and everything.
But that's your max.
Very excited. So if anyone's listening and in the depths of motherhood, I highly recommend an annual trip with your friends. Book it in advance and
and we just sort of, I mean, it's obviously hard. Like, there's a few girls that can't come who have younger babies, and that's, you know, but we just think there's always next year. Like, there was a few that I missed out on, but it's nice when, you know, you've got one every year to look forward to. And we always just go to the same place because then it's not kind of nice when you have like a familiar place to go to. Like,
how good.
You just know where to go, you know where to eat. Like, it's not like you're trying to do all the new things at once. It's just like, I like it here. It's fun for everyone. Let's just do that.
So good.
Yeah. So excited. Anyway, that's rub it in any longer.
Yeah. Well, my family's out going feral. Hopefully they're all being fed at the moment and they'll be happy when they come back out.
Yes, hopefully. Well, today on the episode, we're welcoming back Dr. Eliza Hannam, who we've had on before. We'll pop her other episode in the show notes. She's a GP, a international board certified lactation consultant. She's also a POSSUMS accredited sleep. Is that what you call her? Sleep.
I think neuroprotective.
Oh, she explains it in the episode because it's not called that anymore. Anyway, basically a gentle sleep specialist, I guess you would call her. She's incredible. She wears so many hats. And so we really loved this episode. It's a great one in terms of normalizing infant sleep, but then also some practical tips of some things you can actually do to help infant sleep that doesn't involve any sleep training. So, yeah, we thought it might be a really timely episode for you coming up with the 4-month progression, regression, whatever you want to call it. So,
gosh.
Yes, re-listen to this one.
I will.
I'm over that hill. Although, to be honest, the last three nights I've had a kid in my bed every night awake for like 2 hours, so I'm not quite over that hill. My 5-year-old, so anyway, it doesn't end, does it?
No, you're not giving me much hope. we're in a good spot at the moment, but I'll bookmark this one for later.
Anyway, we hope you love this episode.
Welcome back to Boob to Food, the podcast, Dr. Eliza. We are so excited to have you back again. We loved speaking to you last time all about growth charts, but today we wanted to pick your brain about another aspect of the work that you do, and you do so many different beautiful things in your work. If people haven't heard of you before or haven't listened to that previous episode, could you just let everyone know who you are and what it is that you do?
Sure. So I'm Eliza. I'm a GP. I'm a board certified lactation consultant, and I did training with POSSUMS to be able to help families with feeding and sleep support. And I have founded a small clinic in Sydney, Nurtured Medical, where we exclusively help families with feeding and sleep, kind of using the principles of the POSSUM sleep program.
Amazing. Cool. And that's what we wanted to talk to you about today, all things sleep.
And you're also a mum, we should add.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, so yeah, you have some first-hand experience.
A mum, wife, I've got three kids who all have had low sleep needs, and I'm currently still co-sleeping with my youngest child. So I've very much lots of lived experience too. Mm-hmm.
How old is your youngest?
She is just 17 months.
Yep. Wow. Yeah, so definitely lots of learned experience and some tired brains. I'm really tired today too. Will was in my bed a lot.
Yeah, I said last night was actually a particularly rough one. So I'm feeling that too.
We can all be, Kate's 39 weeks pregnant. Will was in my bed all night.
Like, Bowie was in our bed last night too.
Was it a full moon or something?
Yeah.
Can you mentioned that you work under a POSSUMS framework. Can you explain what POSSUMS is?
Yeah, so POSSUMS originally is a charity that was founded by Dr. Pamela Douglas about 10 years ago, based on her kind of research and observations relating to infant sleep, feeding and brain development. And she kind of created this program or approach to infant sleep, which she called neuroprotective developmental care, or NDC, which is sort of, it's not like a program, you know, a strict kind of schedule or anything. It's just more of a holistic approach to infant feeding and sleep and development, and to the parents' mental health. And I suppose, generally speaking, it's founded on attachment parenting principles, and on an understanding of just biologically normal infant sleep and feeding and behaviour. And it's, I guess, the approach to sleep disputes a lot of the sleep training industry advice, which suggests that sleep is a skill that you can teach your baby, or a learned skill, and it rather frames sleep as just a biological need. And that the way we can help our babies sleep is through the optimization of their two biological sleep regulators, so their circadian clock and their sleep pressure. So it's not a one-size-fits-all or a particular program or schedule, but rather a general approach or philosophy that aims to support families and their specific values and their specific goals, and it encourages experimentation. And importantly, it just honours that each baby have their own individual temperament and their own individual sleep needs. And that's, you know, why for some families those schedules and those programs just don't really work. But I would just say that sadly, Possums the Charity doesn't exist now. So Dr. Douglas has started a new organisation, which I believe is called the NDC Institute. And at the moment, she does continue to offer training to health professionals who want to be able to support families with feeding and sleep. And I understand that the plan is to also be able to offer that support to families as it was through Possums. And that's kind of coming in the following months.
Yeah. Okay, great. We'll make sure we link all of the things in the show notes and definitely you as well, because, yeah, as we mentioned, you work under this framework, so people can come to you directly for your professional advice.
Yeah, and but if also not me, I've got work with a wonderful team of practitioners who've also done the same training, so we all follow that philosophy.
And so you mentioned biologically normal infant sleep. What would we consider to actually be normal when it comes to the sleep of our children?
Great question. So I would say for a very young newborn in that first few months of life, it is normal that a baby, in particular in the day, sleeps best in the arms of a parent. So I still see families who worry that letting their baby sleep on them is creating bad habits, or are made to feel often guilty that it's somehow a bad thing. But I would argue it is biologically normal. We as humans, we're mammals, and, you know, all other mammal species, the breastfed baby sleeps with and close to and next to and on the breastfeeding mother or parent. So, and we as a mammal species are actually particularly vulnerable. So lots of other mammals can walk basically when they're born. And, you know, it takes us years and years to be able to feed ourselves or to walk. And so like as a protective mechanism, they feel safest like in the arms of their mother or parent. So so for the first few months, I said very normal, especially in the day, that they want to sleep on you, and that's okay and that's normal and it passes. Beyond that, it's normal for babies to wake overnight and to need help falling back to sleep overnight. I would also say it's normal, even though sleep is a biological need, it's also counterintuitively normal that babies need help to fall asleep, rather. So, as I said, it's not a skill that you can teach, it's something they need, but they also just need help, they need co-regulation basically to help calm down their sympathetic nervous system, let their parasympathetic nervous system take over, let the sleep pressure take over, let the circadian clock take over, but they kind of just need that help switching off. And all of those things, I think, would constitute normal sleep, biologically normal sleep.
I'm looking forward to having a sleepy baby in my arms again. I think it's
so nice.
Like third time around, first time around, I really relished that. But you definitely have those moments where you're like, am I going to just be holding a child rocking forever? And then it does pass and it's kind of devastating. And now I'm like, I can't remember the last time my eldest, fell asleep on me.
Yeah, exactly. I think there is something special about knowing it's normal, that it passes, that it's not a bad thing. And also I think sometimes just surrendering to, like, that might be what your day looks like. And I think if you tend to be someone who's busy and goal-driven and used to doing things and achieving things, it's really hard just to accept, actually, today what I'm doing is letting my baby sleep on me. But I would also say for my second and third, like, baby carriers were how I survived, basically, because it's lovely to have a baby sleeping on you, but if you've got an older child or children, like, you have to look after them too. And basically I think my younger two slept in the carrier in the day for the first few months of their life, and I didn't even try and put them down, basically.
Yeah, I was the same with Bowie.
Yeah.
I liked the carriers, but I felt like touched out. I felt like I needed, like I did use them a lot, still multiple times a day, but I also loved the pram. Then I could still get out and about, but they weren't on me the whole time, but like it was still nice for me to, you know, be with them and rocking them in the pram. But then I could have my hands free to play with the other two when, you know, because then I felt guilty if I couldn't. I'm like, oh, mom can't bend over because the carrier or I don't know.
Yeah, and I think you were just like also accepting and honouring the fact that your baby needed help falling asleep, that can look different. And I'd say while it's generally normal for babies to want to sleep on a parent, there are some babies who from birth actually really need and crave their own space, and that's totally fine and not a problem. And some babies really love movement, and some babies, you know, like to have their head stroked, and some babies like to feed to sleep. I think it's more just knowing it's normal and it's okay that your baby needs help to fall asleep, and that's not creating a bad habit, but how that happens can look different for different families and different babies.
Do you then, like, what I know, you know, you talked about sort of normalizing things, and I guess that really just, that's what a lot of women just need and families just need, is just to know that it's normal, it'll pass. But are there like specific things that you teach or strategize with families to optimize sleep? Because obviously, you know, we can say, oh, this is beautiful, and our little one, you know, will just sleep with us and that's beautiful. But also, like, if your little one's waking up 8 times a night, like, gets not beautiful pretty quick. So are there things that you do to help our little ones have longer stretches of sleep?
Yeah. So I think, I guess whilst acknowledging that waking overnight is normal, there's definitely times when that is outside of the normal range. So I guess we commonly quote that waking like up to 2 hourly overnight for the first year of life can be normal for some babies, but that it should be quick and easy for everyone to get back to sleep. It's just literally like stirring at the end of a sleep cycle, little bit of help, go back to sleep, everyone goes back to sleep. That can be, unfortunately, within normal. But waking more often than that, it being really difficult to get a baby back to sleep, being awake for hours in the middle of the night, they'd all be considered, I guess, excessive or outside of a normal range. And from a POSSUMS or neuroprotective developmental care approach, we talk about, as I said, just optimizing those two sleep regulators as a way to hopefully get some longer stretches of sleep, or at least just to make it easier and quicker to get a baby back to sleep. So those sleep regulators are the circadian clock, as I said, and heat, sleep, wake, homeostat, or sleep pressure. And so the body clock is, your circadian clock is the same as us as adults. It tells us day versus night. It's largely regulated by melatonin and other hormones, which themselves are largely regulated by the sun. So that's why once a baby kind of is a lot more alert and awake, they're going to have typically like shorter naps in the day and then hopefully longer stretches of sleep at night. That's because of that melatonin and that circadian regulation. And when babies are first born, they don't make their own melatonin. And that's why a lot of newborns obviously don't know the difference between day and night. But wonderfully, you know, our bodies, if we're breastfeeding, do know the difference between day and night. So nighttime breast milk is much higher in melatonin than other hormones that support sleep. So we can kind of help give our babies some melatonin until they make their own if they're breastfed. But otherwise, in the first few kind of weeks or months of life, a baby will start to produce their own melatonin and start to develop some of that day-night differentiation. And the things that we can do to help encourage that include just helping to have a really obvious difference between the day and night environments. So daytime feeds and sleep in, you know, bright, noisy daytime environments, there's really no need to, for young babies or even older babies, put them to sleep in a blacked out, you know, white noise, quiet room. And the other thing that can be helpful as they get older is to have a fairly consistent time that the day starts. That kind of really sets up that 24-hour clock. So bedtime can be a lot more flexible around what's happening in the day, but having a fairly consistent wake time can be helpful. So breastfeeding continues to support a baby's circadian clock for as long as that's happening. And so for a lot of families, like co-sleeping and feeding overnight actually just helps with their baby's circadian regulation. And the other thing that can be helpful is some evening sunlight. So again, probably for those older babies, toddlers, even kids, we know that evening sunlight helps to boost their natural melatonin levels, and that can help support sleep. And probably it also helps them just to get some energy burnt off and helps us all to get outside and get some fresh air, which supports good sleep.
What's evening as well. Evening sunlight? Is that afternoon?
Evening
like
sunlight.
The afternoon?
Oh, yeah, afternoon. I was like, yeah.
Okay. What do you mean?
Yeah, doesn't have to be specific. Basically later in the day, okay. Before it gets dark, getting some sunlight. And that might, honestly, it might just be being in a well-lit area of your house if that's all that manageable, or stepping outside onto your balcony or onto the street, mm-hmm. or a little walk around the block. And so sometimes whenever I'm suggesting trying to help stretch out that time between the last nap and bedtime, say, like, is it manageable to have a walk around the block, mm-hmm. you know, just for everyone, but also to get some of that melatonin levels up.
I love everything you suggested there except for the regular starting time of the day. I think
that is one of the hardest sells when I'm talking to parents about strategies for their baby's sleep. But sometimes that looks like it might be you know, if a breastfeeding mum's been doing most of the resetting overnight, that might be dad's up at that consistent time. It might be that parents take turns. You know that you one morning a week, it's not going to be you. Like, that looks different, although it's so much harder, I'd say, with older kids as well. Mm.
So do you suggest...
It might be them who dictate the start time of the day, to be honest.
Do you suggest waking the baby up in the morning at the same time, like if they're still asleep?
It sounds so unappealing. but what I often suggest is, like, just opening up the curtains, have that background household noise. It's not, you know, like...
You're not setting an alarm.
Shaking your baby awake.
Mm. Yeah.
Not... Well,
or maybe
not necessarily, except if there's like clearly some, you know, the circadian clock seems to be quite dysregulated. Yeah. It can be helpful just for a couple of weeks to set an alarm and to have that consistency. But what I would say is pick the earlier end of your baby's normal window. Mm-hmm. So if your baby naturally wakes between, say, 7:30 and 8:30, then at 7:30 for a couple of weeks, like opening up the curtains, I said, having some noise, really like gentle, but just letting them their bodies know it's daytime now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it takes a couple of weeks to reset, just like, you know, for jet lag. Mm. And so it's not something you're necessarily going to be having to do forever. But if we're really trying to make sure that we're kind of setting and resetting that body clock, it can be helpful just for a couple of weeks to have a fairly consistent wake time.
I don't know why I'm concerned.
It doesn't have to be.
I've never had children who sleep in, so it's not like I'm like, you're telling me that you have to move your 8:30 a.m. wake up to 6 a.m. I'm already up at 6 a.m.
Yeah, so I mean, it's kind of easier with younger babies because the household tends to start at a certain time of day. But it might be, if it's feasible, I said that dad or the other parent is up with the kids for an hour and mum gets an extra hour's sleep, might be possible for some families, you know, which makes it a little bit easier.
I have for once a sleeping in baby.
Oh, yeah,
like,
you
Will
do.
Sleeps in and it's so nice. And he hasn't done it the last 3 days. And I'm like, oh, I hope I didn't take this for granted because I really like the sleep. I don't sleep in. I get up for the gym at like 5:30. So I'm not sleeping in anyway. But it's nice to come home and he's still asleep. And then I have a shower and stuff. But anyway, apart from that, no, I never experienced sleeping in babies either.
And you mentioned the other part of the approach was the sleep pressure. Is that right?
Yeah. Yep, that's right. So, yeah, sleep-wake homeostat, sleep pressure, which basically just means tiredness. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that, you know, a young baby who's, say, having a couple of naps in a day, I always use my hands for this, but I appreciate people can't see that, but that they start the day with low sleep pressure, it builds up, they have a nap to take the edge off, builds up, has a nap to take the edge off, builds up, has a nap to take the edge off, and then builds right up, hopefully before bedtime. So the idea is that a nap is not meant to remove all sleep pressure or tiredness, it's just to remove some of it, to kind of get on with the next wake window and the next activity. And the other thing that's really important is that it's helpful for babies to go to bed with really high sleep pressure, exhausted, really tired, so that they hopefully quickly and easily fall asleep and then stay asleep, and then gradually over the night that sleep pressure or that tiredness will slowly wear off is the idea. I think the problem or the difficulties with a lot of those strict schedules is that it assumes all babies should be awake for the same amount of time to build up sleep pressure and then asleep for the same amount of time to take the edge back off, but it doesn't acknowledge the fact that there's actually a huge variation in normal. So, you know, some babies might be ready for their next nap after being awake for an hour, and some babies the same age, it might be more like 3. And for some babies to take the edge off their sleep pressure, it might take 20 minutes, and for others it might take 2 hours, and everything in between is normal. So I think what's helpful is to kind of learn your baby and to understand when they seem to be really nice and tired, that kind of sweet spot, like tired enough that it's quick and easy to help them to get to sleep pretty easily and quickly, and but not too tired that they're then so dialed up and so cranky and so tired that it's actually a lot of work to get them back. To help them off to sleep.
I was going to say that because with the sleep pressure, like sometimes, you know, especially with my firstborn, he was a really, really like never slept more than 20, 30 minutes ever in the day. But it wasn't like that was a good thing by nighttime. It was like he was so overtired and overdone that it would take hours to get him to sleep every night. So it's hard to like know, you know, what that sleep, you know, you can say sleep pressure, but then sometimes it's like they go the other way.
It's a tricky one to read. But I think like sometimes it's experimentation to kind of see, you know, if we stretch it a little bit more, is that going to make things easier or harder, for example? And sometimes I would say sleep pressure builds up over several days. So it might be that your baby's had a couple of days of going to bed a bit later or sleeping a bit less in the day, and then they really need to catch up and have a lot more sleep. Over time, this is an interesting one. So there's this idea out there that possums doesn't believe in overtiredness. And as a parent, I know that overtiredness definitely exists. But I think the possum's way of framing it is that just like us as adults, when we're really tired, you get cranky, and they're kind of the same. So when your baby's really tired, their sympathetic nervous system can become upregulated, they can feel dysregulated, and it's a bit harder to help them to co-regulate or to down-regulate to take the sleep that they need. But I guess what I don't think is true is that a baby who's overtired going to bed will then wake more at night. I think that just doesn't really make sense from a sleep biology point of view. So I think if they're really tired going into a sleep, it might mean that they need more help and more co-regulation. But once you have helped them to fall asleep, it shouldn't continue to cause issues for the rest of the night. And if you've got a baby who's waking a lot through the night, it's not usually a factor that I'd be looking at whether they're overtired going to bed, if that makes sense. And so, yeah, as I said, it's going to look a little bit different, naps and bedtime for each baby, because sleep pressure is a little bit different for each baby. But I think the other thing is we get probably had about a few bad experiences like you did. We get really scared of like not wanting your baby to get tired or overtired, but ultimately it's not harmful for a baby to get tired. And sometimes it's just a bit of trial and error. And also for second, third, subsequent children, you might know they're tired, but actually like in that exact moment, you can't help them fall asleep. And so they do get a little bit tired while you're helping the older siblings or doing something else. And that's okay. And so it doesn't cause them great harm to their health or well-being or development to get a bit tired. It's just more that they might need a bit of extra help getting off to sleep again.
Yeah, I never found it like made a difference overnight. You slept not very well regardless. But yeah, it was just more the like getting to sleep.
Fighting bedtime.
Yeah, it was just like every night I just remember being such a battle, whereas with my other two who napped better, who would like do longer stretches of naps, bedtime wasn't a battle. It was quite easy and they went to bed. It was like that sweet spot like you talk about, like they went to bed quite easily. But, yeah, with my – I know it was probably also just me like having no idea what I was doing first time around and, trying everything under the sun.
I think also temperament plays into it. Yeah. I think, you know, that's one of the things, again, that sleep programs don't acknowledge, is that some babies just temperamentally – get dialed up more easily, their sympathetic nervous system gets activated more easily, or they're just particularly sensitive or need a lot more touch and a lot more co-regulation. And so that can be the other reason why it might be really different between your kids. Like partly I would agree. I think like as parents we probably chill out with each child and you kind of can bounce off each other in that way. But also I don't know your kids now, but possibly will just had a bit of a different temperament to the others.
Yeah. But so when you were saying about those little ones that do wake up, you know, every hour or 40 minutes or something, what would be some things that you would be looking at then for those little ones?
So really just those sleep regulators. So I'd be looking at, you know, is their wake time consistent? Are they you know, because they feel like they should, encouraging really long naps in dark, quiet rooms late in the day. Because I said it's tricky. It might be that a parent has it in their idea, an idea in their mind that sleep breeds sleep, for example, is one of those great phrases you'll hear in the sleep training industry. And so in that belief, they're really encouraging their baby to have lots and lots of sleep in the day, in particular late in the day. So sometimes it might be looking at, are they having too much sleep in the day, especially close to bedtime? Are they having long naps in dark nighttime environments? You know, is there enough time going into bedtime? Are they filling up their sensory cup? So it's kind of for that individual baby, looking at how much sleep does it look like they need in 24 hours? How can we help to kind of shift that more at nighttime, more consolidated sleep at nighttime, and what might that look like for the daytime for that baby? You know, what do their kind of wake windows look like, as in how long does that baby need to be awake before they're tired enough to easily fall asleep? So I think it's looking at the individual, the family, that specific baby, and then how we can help to optimize the two sleep regulators for them specifically, if that makes sense.
So awake windows are a thing. They're just different for every baby. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, they're obviously a controversial one. Mm. What I would say is, like, strict wake windows saying, you know, at this age your baby should be awake for this time. Like it doesn't accept the fact that there's a huge variation in normal. And some babies are quite consistent, like at a particular age, you can generally see that after 2 hours in the morning, they're typically ready for a nap, and then about 3 hours before their next nap, and then 3.5 hours, they're ready for bed. And so understanding that as a parent can just help you to, like, structure your day, if nothing else, to know, that looks like this is how the day is going to look today. And also if they start to get really cranky and it's been 3.5 hours, you think, oh, yeah, that makes sense, you're tired, let's try and help facilitate that. But there are some babies where it fluctuates widely from day to day. And that's definitely my third child. Like, there has been no predictability with her from birth, basically. I feel like she just listened to me when I was pregnant and was like, I'm going to really test how committed you are to biologically normal infant sleep. But, you know, some days, even now, like yesterday, she fell asleep at 9:30 in the morning. And then some days she doesn't need a nap till 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And there's not really any predictability. So I think it should be kind of obvious if your baby seems to have some, like, consistency in terms of when they really are tired. And so then the other part of it is that they are then really easy to help support to sleep, and some don't. And unfortunately, if your baby falls into the latter, you can't really make them fit into it. And then I would say just watch your baby, you know, if they're starting to clearly be dysregulated and you don't think they're hungry and they've had plenty of sensory stimulation, possibly they're tired, and what can you do to help to downregulate that sympathetic nervous system to see if the sleep pressure takes over?
We'll be back after this short break.
Today's episode is brought to you by Farmer Joe. We both really love Farmer Joe and their delicious range of granolas and cereals, which are made from the finest natural whole foods made here in Australia. I love that they use whole food ingredients and you can actually see what you're eating. So whole nuts and seeds. Their paleo granola is my favorite. It's so delicious and keeps me full for ages. And my kids really love their cereal, which we love to bring in the caravan. And I love it because it gives me a little bit of a sleep in, which is always very, very welcomed.
Yeah, we just took their granola and cereal away camping as well, and it made for very easy and very delicious breakfasts. They're also available in Coles, Woolworths, Harris Farm and IGA, so pretty easy to track down. Or, of course, you can see their whole range online at www.farmerjoe.com.au, and we actually have a discount code which is BOOBTOFOOD for 10% off all of their products online.
Now let's get back to today's episode.
I've definitely had, both my kids have been really low sleep needs. Like, they were both dropping naps well before I expected.
Yeah.
And even, like, I'm still shocked at, you know, friends who have children around a similar age. Like, I found both of mine dropped their naps entirely. Jude was before he turned two and Bowie was just after she was two. But we have friends who, you know, they have three-year-olds who will still have, like, a 2 or 3 hour nap and then go to bed at 7 p.m. And I think, if my children close their eyes for even 5 minutes, they're awake till 9:30. So it's like, it's interesting. And I think I always sort of had the mentality of, oh, well, whatever it's going to be, it's going to be. And not that that was always easy. Like, there was definitely some days when I was like, why does it have to be like this? But I think just knowing that, that variation between infants all the way, I mean, even adults, like, we have such a huge variation in our sleep needs and how we like to fall asleep and how settled that sleep is. So just being okay with that.
It's not surprising they're the same. Yeah, so I think, you know, we'd quote, like, some newborns might need only 9 or 10 hours sleep in 24 hours and some might need 16 to 18 and everything is normal. And there's absolutely no indication that a baby at that 9 or 10 hours is in any way developmentally or physically disadvantaged. It's kind of just seems to be genetically the way they are, or not genetically. I have 3 very low sleep needs baby and I would consider myself quite high sleep needs.
Especially now.
But yeah, you just can't, unfortunately, you can't change how much sleep they need. They are who they are. We can a little bit influence how it's broken up into day or night. But yeah, you can't make your baby need more sleep than they do, unfortunately.
Would you recommend, so I've got friends on different ends of the spectrum. I've got friends that have gone down the sleep training route. I've got friends that are so relaxed that, you know, I'm like, oh my gosh, it's 6 p.m. and your baby's having a nap now. Like, you know, you've got very different ends of the spectrum. It's funny just watching everyone does it very differently. But would you recommend, like, using the Possum's approach that babies have, like, a set bedtime or, you know, like, would you, so say one of my friends who's very relaxed and parents beautifully and she's always relaxed and the babies just nap wherever on her. They all co-sleep. It's lovely. But, like, they don't go to bed till, like, 9:30, like, which is fine for them, it works for them. But is that the thing? Like, if it works for you, it works for you, and just do that? Or do you think that, like, biologically, we should kind of be going, like, our children should go to bed a bit earlier?
No, it's a great question. So, whilst a consistent wake time can be helpful for the circadian clock, bedtime doesn't have to be and can very much be what works for your baby and your family. And I'd say, you know, internationally in lots of other cultures and countries, it's normal for kids to go to bed at 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night. Yeah. And there's no evidence that they are in any way, you know, less healthy or less developed than in countries where it's more common for, say, a 7 o'clock bedtime. But so bedtime's really based around that sleep-wake home, is that sleep pressure. So for babies who, and a little bit their own natural body clock as well, like, some babies just are night owls and some babies are early risers. And as you said, that's just kind of who they are. But if you've got a baby whose natural clock tends to want to fall asleep a bit later, they will often have a nap later in the day. Mm-hmm. And they're pretty good at taking what they need, I guess. So if a later bedtime works for your family, there's nothing wrong with that. And for some families, especially if both parents are working long days, actually those few hours in the evening are the only time they get together as a family, and then they all just go to bed together, and that's completely fine. But for other families, you know, as parents, they really want that time for a couple of hours between the baby going to bed and they're going to bed. And so for their child, it actually might be that they really don't need a lot of sleep in the day and certainly don't need a nap late in the day, because invariably it will affect sleep pressure going into bedtime. Mm. As you said, Kate, my kids are the same. If they have a nap, there's like this weird time warp situation where 10 minutes nap somehow equals like 3 hours later bedtime. I'm exaggerating, but
it is, though.
You know, it is crazy. For some kids, they're just so sensitive. Their sleep pressure just can be gone with such little sleep in the day that an earlier bedtime might mean really very little sleep in the day and dropping their nap quite early, as you said.
It's so the same for adults, though. Hey, like, if I haven't, I do not nap, but if I did have
unless
a nap.
Unless you go to see Barbie.
Yeah, I napped in Barbie and I couldn't sleep then that night. So, yeah, if I have a nap, it takes me so long to get to sleep, whereas normally, my head hits the pillow and I'm out. But, yeah, so it's the same for adults, so we can't really expect that much different for our children, can we?
Yeah, exactly. And I often say to parents, like, if we every day put ourselves to sleep for 3 hours in a dark, quiet room, like, yes, you might be able to sleep because your body thinks it's nighttime, but, of course, it will inevitably affect nighttime sleep eventually. Mm. I mean, I've got about 7 years of sleep pressure built up, I reckon. I'd be okay for a while. But eventually, I know that it would impact on either falling asleep or staying asleep at night. So, of course, it makes sense that for some kids it's the same.
Mm. And what if, you know, what is kind of our baby's normal and what their cues are showing us is actually not working for us? Like, what if, you know, mom or dad or whoever's the caregiver is really struggling with the way their child sleeps?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think as parents, it's helpful just to understand and accept that we can't change our baby's temperament and we can't change their sleep needs. And so actually if it's feeling unmanageable, then sometimes it's about just accepting that my baby is not going to sleep anymore. So how can I fill my own cup or get my own self-care in that's not contingent on my baby magically needing more sleep?
Yeah.
And I guess what is it that's feeling particularly unmanageable? And for some parents, it's not having any time to themselves in the day. And so then I say, your baby's not going to suddenly need to nap more. So, you know, do you have options, someone to come and look after your baby for a couple of hours? Or would you feel comfortable dropping them at the crate at the swimming pool and having a swim? Mm. Or, you know, do you have a neighbor or a family friend who can come and help out for an hour? So I guess finding that time that's not going to need your baby to be asleep to have it. Mm. And for some parents, I said it might be that it's kind of what's feeling really unmanageable is that late bedtime. So is it that actually you accept basically no day sleep so that bedtime comes a bit earlier? And also for some families, like the conversation goes to, you know, if what's feeling most unmanageable is getting up every couple of hours a night, is then, you know, would it feel easier with your baby sleeping closer, whether that's in your bed or in a sidecar cot, so very close? Because we know that parents who aren't necessarily physically getting up out of bed to resettle a baby up to sleep and then going back to sleep themselves tend to fall asleep more quickly if the baby's just really close by, and so does the baby. So that I'd sort of check the baby sleep regulators, check there's nothing going on there, talk about self-care, talk about getting that time back. But sometimes if it's the night waking that's feeling unmanageable and it's within, I guess, a biologically normal, albeit really tricky end of the spectrum, then it's saying, like, what would make the nights feel more manageable? Is it, I said, having baby close or in bed with you? Is it splitting the night with your partner and another parent if there is another parent around to help? Is it that you alternate? Is it that you swap, you know, nights? So I guess that's one of the biggest things about possums is rather than the goal being for your baby to sleep more or to sleep through the night, it's about the nights feeling as manageable as possible and the days feeling as enjoyable as possible, basically within whatever sleep your baby needs or whatever is normal for them.
What if our little one wants a breastfeed every time that they wake up and it's not feeling manageable for you? Is there a specific age where you would say, okay, well, it's probably okay if you cut some breastfeeds overnight or if you night weaned?
Yeah. I mean, I'd first of all say a lot of babies might need feeds for the first 12 months, for example, overnight. Yep. And certainly them falling back asleep with a feed is not necessarily about hunger. As I said, they get a little burst of melatonin and they get that oxytocin, and so it's really like sleep promoting. So a lot of babies wanting or needing to feed back to sleep is not necessarily about the feed. And so, you know, up until the point where it's not feeling manageable, there's nothing wrong with just feeding a baby every time they wake up if it's the way that everyone gets back to sleep as quick as possible. But if that's getting to the point where it is feeling unmanageable, I mean, for some family that's feeling particularly hard, under 12 months, it might be a conversation around not feeding every single time they awake, every single hour or 2 hours, and looking at other ways that, you know, ideally another parent could be involved to help settling them back to sleep. If a mom or a family is looking to move away from feeding overnight fully, then I usually wouldn't suggest parent-led night weaning until after 12 months. And we know that after that time that babies don't typically need the calories. Yep. And for some babies, not feeding to sleep every time actually helps them to learn other ways to co-regulate, and it helps the nights to feel more manageable. And for a lot of families, 18 months is an age when it feels easier again. A lot of babies tend to have kind of language and understanding, that they can understand day versus night. They can understand the idea of full and empty, or more or no more. And so sometimes the conversation is, you know, it's nighttime, there's no more milk, or the milk's gone to sleep, you're back in the morning. And it can just feel a bit easier when they've got that understanding. Whereas I guess if you were looking to night weaning closer to 12 months, they might not have that language, and it might just be a little bit more of a transition, and is often easier if the other parent is involved, if that's possible.
Yeah, I feel like what we hear is, I mean, it's definitely hard at any age, but I feel like it's the more over 12 months where you start to hear they're like, I can't keep doing this.
Yeah.
You know, like,
and that, when you're to be like, honest,
you don't
about
actually
12
need the food.
Yeah.
And I feel like you feel by 12 months, you feel more confident that they're eating well, that they are doing it for comfort. I think my children were around 18 months when I night weaned, because like you said, they had like more communication skills, and I just felt like it was easier for me. But then to replace that, like, we just co-slept, because I thought I'm still giving, you know, I know I didn't feel guilty, because I said I'm still here giving you love, cuddles, and just not giving you milk.
Yeah. And so some parents do feel touched out, and sometimes it's just wanting to share it, I think, is the other thing. Like, it's hard if it can only be mum or only the breastfeeding parent.
So with self-settling, then, is self-settling really like our golden ticket to get good sleep?
So the short answer is no, I would say. And it's certainly not something you can teach your baby to self-settle. And so I think for parents who are worried and guilty that they haven't yet taught their baby to self-settle, you can let go of that, because it's just not a skill you can teach. I mean, what we're really talking about is whether a baby can like self-regulate when they're feeling dysregulated to then fall asleep. And I would say, like, when I'm feeling dysregulated, I find it really hard to self-settle and to fall asleep as an adult. And so it's okay that our young babies can't do the same, and they need us to help them to co-regulate and to down-regulate. And actually, you know, what we know is a repeated pattern of responding and of helping your baby and helping to co-regulate doesn't make them dependent on us to do that. It actually teaches them those skills that they can then do when they're ready. So kind of, as I said, some babies, like, temperamentally are pretty independent and pretty happy to fall asleep on their own from a really young age, but others really need help from their parents for a lot longer. And it's not something that you have done wrong as a parent if your baby is like that. I said, and I have so many people come and worry that they've created this baby that can't self-settle. And I'd say, I think you've just responded beautifully to your baby and their needs and their temperament. And that repeated response and that, you know, beautiful attuned caregiving will teach them in time that they're, you know, safe and can help themselves get back to sleep when they're ready.
Sometimes I think we just need validation that we're doing a good job. Hey, you just second guess everything, and when your baby's not, you know, doing what the textbooks say or what your other friend's baby's doing, you can really just second guess everything. Yeah. But when you've got a baby that sleeps all night, you can definitely think, oh, like, I'm doing it right. But it's so not the case, isn't it?
And I think for some families where they've got one baby who's been, you know, a good sleeper, had high sleep needs, temperamentally quite independent from the start, and they think, oh, got this, and then they have a baby who's different, it's that realisation that, oh, I didn't actually do something specifically right the first time. It was just the luck of the draw, basically.
Yeah. And we know that so many, like, women and families do bed share and co-sleep. Can you share any tips on, like, how we can do this safely? Because you hear so many, you know, things like, don't do it because of, you know, SIDS and things like that. But it's in reality, even if you don't plan to co-sleep, you probably at some stage of your life are going to.
So it's good to know how to do it safely. Exactly. We know 75 to 80% of families will co-sleep at some point in the first year. And I would also say there are some families who are so terrified that they're not co-sleeping, but maybe they're falling asleep sitting on the lounge with their baby on them, or falling asleep while they're sitting up in bed feeding. And actually, like, that is so much more unsafe. So I'd say, whether it's intentional or whether it's because you're accidentally falling asleep in an unsafe environment, it's really important to understand how to do it safely. And that, as you say, because there has been a link between co-sleeping and SIDS. But I think what people don't understand is that it kind of lumps all like surface sharing in together. So it, you know, sleeping on a lounge or sleeping in a chair is kind of included in that data. And it's also because we know that sometimes co-sleeping is associated with other factors which are themselves linked with SIDS. So it's not the co-sleeping itself that's dangerous, it's the other factors. And so safe bed sharing is about like eliminating those other factors. And so that means, I said, sleeping on a bed, on a firm mattress, not on a chair. And actually, interestingly, I should have posted about this recently, but sleeping on a chair with your baby sleeping on you has a higher risk of SIDS than even smoking. So if that's happening, just learn how to safely bed share, basically, is my take home. It's important that neither parent is under the influence of drugs or alcohol that has a similar risk factor for SIDS to sleeping on a chair or a sofa. It's important that neither parents are smokers. And so that's tricky for some families, and for some families the only solution is parents sleep separately if their non-smoking parent wants to co-sleep. It's important that the baby is term and has a normal birth weight. So we know that premature and low birth weight babies are at increased risk of SIDS in that first couple of months. And so for those families, like a co-sleeper bassinet or some other arrangement might be a safer alternative. We know that, you know, for safe co-sleeping in those first few months, the baby should be breastfed, ideally. The baby can't be swaddled if they're in bed with the parents, so no sheets or blankets or pillows near the baby, no spaces where they can kind of get stuck or entrapped, like between a bed and the wall or a bed rail or something like that, so you want the baby free from all of those. And ideally no pets or siblings in the bed as well. So I think, pets are just because they can smother babies accidentally. Older siblings, I think it's a couple of things. I think older siblings aren't going to be aware of where the baby is in the same way that a parent is. But I also, I feel like for me, I would find it hard to tune in exclusively to my baby if I knew one of my other children were in bed. You kind of have to like be aware of both of them, and probably that means you as it can't be as in tune with the baby that's a young baby that's sleeping next to you. So all of those things, I guess, are what constitute safe bed sharing.
I've loved it. I've always intended on having the kids in the bed with me, and I just think, oh gosh, I don't think I could do this differently from that perspective of needing to wake up and get out of bed and being like fully roused to feed and settle a baby. Like, I don't think I would have any chance of going back to sleep. So for me, I know it's not for everyone, but having the kids right there, that even though we had like very frequent wake ups and, you know, lots of overnight breastfeeds for so many years, it allowed me to still, like, I think I felt more rested at times now when I have like my moments of pregnancy insomnia and I'm awake for like 3 hours in the middle of the night.
That's what the data tells us, is that breastfeeding parents with co-sleeping might wake more, but they usually report waking feeling more rested. And that was absolutely my experience. Like, I couldn't have gone back to work if I wasn't co-sleeping and just feeding every time my baby woke. And I was the same. Like, I'd wake up in the morning and think, I have no idea how many times I woke up, but actually feel okay despite that on a good night. And it can, and I think, you know, I'd say it is quite natural for us as mammal species. So I agree, it doesn't work for everyone, but there's a reason I think why it feels right. And it can be lovely sometimes. And it also, I said, there are benefits, as you said. So certainly we know that it helps support sleep for mums and babies, or breastfeeding parents and babies. We know that it supports breastfeeding. So there's higher rates of initiation and longer duration of breastfeeding for mums and babies that co-sleep. And it's actually, interestingly, statistically protective against SIDS for breastfed babies. So whilst we have it in our mind, you know, co-sleeping increases the risk of SIDS, actually for breastfed babies at sort of 2 to 3 months of age, and if there's none of the other factors that would make it unsafe, it actually reduces the risk of SIDS, doesn't increase the risk of SIDS. And that's probably because, you know, the mum and baby are just so, as I said, so in tune and don't go into that really, really deep sleep. You're just so aware of each other that that's probably what is protective against that SIDS or the sudden unexpected death in infancy.
isn't there something, could be fully making this up, to do with the carbon dioxide as well? Like
the exchange of the exchange. Breath.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've heard that too. I can't think what the details are.
But like I know, and it's like something, I've read it somewhere, like it's something to do with like the mother breathing stimulates the baby's breathing
and they start to sink.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. I don't know if it's backed by evidence at all. Certainly sleeping close to, we know that when a mum baby or pregnant babies sleep closely together, that their heart rate and breath rate and things will go in sync. And we know, like, I think, you know, another great evidence that sleeping close to your babies kind of makes sense is like kangaroo care, you know, with little tiny preterm babies who historically we would have just like left them. We've actually shown that being like held by and being close to and on the chest of the parents helps with the regulation of their heart rate and their temperature and their breathing. And that just shows to me how much they are, like, human babies are meant to be held and touched and close, and that it really supports their physiology and development. And I think actually on that note, a lot of people worry if they're co-sleeping, is your baby going to become really dependent? But actually the studies show us that children who had co-slept as babies, you know, show earlier independence and, you know, self-confidence. And I guess not to say if you don't co-sleep that your baby will be harmed in any way, but just that there's no need to be concerned that you're going to make your baby or your child dependent or, you know, affect their independence by co-sleeping when, you know, the opposite has in fact been shown.
Still sleeping, you were 18. I think that's what everyone's worried about. I did want to ask though, with like mothers who aren't breastfeeding, have you got any tips? So there'll be a lot of mothers out there who aren't breastfeeding but that are still co-sleeping just so they don't have to get up so much. But then I really feel for them because then they've got to get up and make bottles, and have you got any tips to make their night a bit easier?
Yeah, it is a really tricky situation and conversation. And I would say for some people who maybe desperately wanted to breastfeed and then it didn't work out and then would love to co-sleep but feel like they can't do it safely, it's kind of just this, it's a really sad situation to be in. I would kind of flag that the highest risk for SIDS is really in that first kind of 2 to 4 months of age. And so, probably having setups like a co-sleeper bassinet might be safer just while the baby's very young if they're not breastfeeding or if they were premature or low birth weight. But once they get older, you know, like a lot of us are talking about co-sleeping with toddlers, it's not really relevant whether they're breastfed or not. So once they're kind of over 6 months, moving around, rolling, of course all the other factors are really important, like not swaddling and not smoking and all those sorts of things. But I would say it can be done more safely once you're out of that peak SIDS age if you're following all of the other guidelines. Otherwise, while they are young, said co-sleeper bassinet can be helpful, or a sidecar cot, sometimes a floor mattress, like a double floor mattress with even a single mattress pushed up against it, can mean you're kind of co-sleeping but there is that slight separation. From a formula point of view, I mean, a lot of babies in that first 2 to 4 months are actually waking less overnight than after that, so they might in fact not be having that many feeds. I would often talk about having your bottles ready with your sterilized water and your powder so that everything's ready to go. See if your baby will happily take room temperature formula so you're not needing to worry about warming up bottles. But otherwise, if your baby really loves a warm bottle, like having your bottle warmer there. So basically having like everything set up so you don't have to leave the bedroom. You maybe don't even have to leave bed. They can still be in arm's reach even if it's not kind of right next to you on the mattress. Instead of knowing that once they're older and they've left that peak SIDS risk age, that if it feels right for your family, it can be done safely if you follow the other guidelines, I think is probably how I'd answer that.
Yeah, that sounds good because, I'm sure everyone will, at least even if you don't plan to co-sleep, like I said, you know, you'll have a bad night, your child will be sick, something will happen and they'll end up in bed with you for whatever reason.
Yeah, exactly. And that doesn't stop when they're little.
It doesn't stop. No, I was just going
to
say.
My five-year-old still... some nights would like to have someone of us lying with him for at least part of the night. So it's pretty common.
I had my five-year-old in my bed last night too because for some reason there was heaps of flies in my house. Like summer finally hit.
Yeah.
And she was scared of the flies.
Oh, honey.
And I was like, are you serious?
I mean, usually at one point in the night, like, it's just easier, isn't it? So,
oh, And I was like, oh, just come in. I'm too tired to argue with Chase this.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Eliza, for coming back on the podcast. I think this will be really, really empowering for families and really supportive. And, yeah, we love chatting to you. We could pick your brain a million times, and I'm sure we will again.
Thanks so much for having me. It's always wonderful.
Thank you for listening to Boob to Food, the podcast. We hope this episode made you feel inspired, confident, and less overwhelmed in your parenting journey.
Head to the show notes for all the resources mentioned on today's episode. And if you loved this podcast, please remember to subscribe, rate, and review.
See you next week. Bye.